Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
It was such a treat of a gig, especially doing a New York, a global institution like SNL. Doing Hamilton was kind of the best sort of come down job, you know? A great rebound gig.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. Today's show features Seth's conversation with his old friend, Taron Killam, who directed, wrote, and stars in the upcoming movie, Killing Gunther. But first, Seth takes a closer look at how powerful men like Donald Trump and Harvey Weinstein have abused their power.
This week, we've seen examples of powerful men at the highest levels of entertainment and politics, from Harvey Weinstein to Donald Trump, abusing their power to silence, bully, or coerce. And it's a reminder that our toxic culture of male entitlement is still very much intact. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. Of course, we have a president who built his political career almost entirely on bullying. His campaign and now his presidency have been, in many ways, a performance of dominance, a performance that has, in many cases, been explicitly misogynist. We saw that just recently when he viciously attacked the mayor of San Juan, Carmen Yulín Cruz, for having the audacity to criticize him and speak up for her constituents.
We have a mayor of San Juan, Puerto Rico, who didn't attend meetings, who didn't work with FEMA, who really did not do a very good job, in fact, did a very poor job, but she's not a capable person.
I'm sorry, she's not a capable person? What did you do after the hurricane? You took a week to even send FEMA, you reminded them about their debts, and then you showed up 2 weeks after that and chucked paper towels like a teenager in the break room at Costco. This is what male entitlement looks like, a woman of color literally wading through floodwaters to help her constituents being attacked by a powerful man so incompetent, he probably floods his own bathroom because he forgets to turn the faucet off. Melania, it happened again. I made a hurricane. Trump is so unqualified for his job that in the last week, a Republican senator has described the White House as adult daycare, and people close to the president have called him unstable and unraveling. One advisor said aides were relieved when Trump declined to appear on 60 Minutes last month because he's lost a step. He's lost a step. He didn't have that many steps to begin with. If he had a Fitbit, it would die of boredom. He literally started his presidential campaign by refusing to take any steps. His main form of transportation is cart. Trump is apparently so clueless that when one of his closest associates warned him that he was in danger of being removed from office, Trump had no idea what he was talking about. Several months ago, former chief strategist Steve Bannon told Trump that the risk to his presidency wasn't impeachment, but the 25th Amendment, the provision by which a majority of the cabinet can vote to remove the president. When Bannon mentioned the 25th Amendment, Trump said, "What's that?" In fairness, most of us probably didn't know the 25th Amendment until recently, but we weren't applying for the job. I can't make a macchiato either, but if I was applying to Starbucks, I would definitely Google it. These are trying times for the president. Trump has apparently been so depressed and angry at the state of his administration and what he sees as disloyalty from his staff that he reportedly told a close associate, "I hate everyone in the White House. There are a few exceptions, but I hate them." His staff talks about him like he's a toddler, but Trump is really a moody teenager whose parents won't let him go to Kevin's lake house for the weekend. I hate everyone in this house. I'm turning the faucets on. Seriously. Based on that, we're like a week away from goth Trump. And when Trump isn't trying to excuse his own failures by lashing out at his staff, he's lashing out at reporters, as he did yesterday when he said it was disgusting that the press is allowed to write whatever they want to write and threatened to revoke the licenses of news outlets he doesn't like. Trump tweeted, "Network news has become so partisan, distorted, and fake that licenses must be challenged and, if appropriate, revoked, not fair to public." Wow. He wants to revoke the broadcast licenses of networks he doesn't like. That's really going to shrink down the channel guide. How do I get it on one? Of course, it should not surprise us that Donald Trump is now trying to silence and bully journalists. It's worth remembering that almost a year ago exactly, Trump tried to silence and bully the 12 women who accused him of sexual harassment by viciously attacking them and even threatening to sue them.
When you looked at that horrible woman last night, you said, "I don't think so. I don't think so." Whoever she is, wherever she comes from, the stories are total fiction.
Every woman lied when they came forward to hurt my campaign. Total fabrication. All of these liars will be sued after the election is over.
And as we know, Donald Trump keeps all his promises. So those women were sued and found guilty at a trial held right next to the finished Mexican border wall on the same day that Obamacare was repealed. Donald Trump is perhaps the most famous example of this kind of abusive male power, but he is by no means the only one, as we learned yet again this week when arguably the most powerful man in Hollywood, Harvey Weinstein, was accused by at least 25 women of sexual harassment and, in 3 cases, rape. And I guess it's no surprise that Weinstein is apparently just as defiant as Donald Trump and reportedly already plotting his comeback.
We spoke to Harvey last night. We've spoken to him a lot, actually. He's been calling the newsroom, panicking, and his mood tends to change. You know, it started out being extremely cavalier about all of these allegations, never fully admitting to what people are claiming that he's done. But we spoke to him last night, and he was defiant, said that he was going to fight these accusations. And he also even said that he was planning a comeback. Like, he expects to continue working and to come back next year.
Next year? You think he can come back in a year? If Weinstein had himself cryogenically frozen and woke up 1,000 years from now, the headline would still be, "Too soon, creep." But I suppose it's not surprising that Weinstein would defiantly plot his comeback just days after being accused of sexual assault, given the perverse ways he and his team tried to rationalize his behavior. Weinstein himself, of course, first insisted, "I came of age in the 60s and 70s when all the rules about behavior in workplaces were different. That was the culture then." And one of his lawyers described Weinstein as an old dinosaur learning new ways. Dinosaurs don't learn new ways. They go extinct. They didn't survive because they learned to type. If you're a dinosaur, then this is your ice age, buddy. And unlike real dinosaurs, no one is ever going to try and bring back Harvey Weinstein. This entire ordeal is yet another window into the entitled mind of powerful, predatory men who are used to operating without consequence. Weinstein thought he could escape the fallout of the allegations against him, as he did for so many years, even though those accusations were horrifying.
At least 25 women, including some of Hollywood's most prominent actresses, have now come forward accusing Weinstein of acts ranging from harassment to rape. Gwyneth Paltrow telling the New York Times that when she was 22, a meeting with Weinstein, quote, ended with him placing his hands on her and suggesting they head to the bedroom for massages. Ashley Judd alleges that 2 decades ago, Weinstein had her sent up to his hotel room and then greeted her in a bathrobe, asking if he could give her a massage or she could watch him shower.
The only reason anyone should ever watch Harvey Weinstein shower is to confirm that it actually happened. He always looks like he just got rescued from a desert island. There is no doubt that this horrifying story reveals yet again a culture of systemic misogyny that exists at the highest levels of society. In the last year and a half, the most powerful man in news, the most powerful man in politics and the most powerful man in Hollywood, have been accused of serial sexual predation. This should not be a partisan issue. It requires all of us to speak out and ask ourselves what we can do to address it. So naturally, some Republicans and right-wing pundits rushed in to exploit the scandal for political gain.
White House counselor Kellyanne Conway slammed Hillary Clinton's response on Twitter with this. It took Hillary about 5 minutes to blame the NRA for Madman's rampage, but 5 days to sort of kind of blame Harvey Weinstein for his sexual assault.
Oh, my God, you work for Donald Trump, remember? You know, big dumb guy about yay high, bragged about sexual assault on a bus, loves to throw paper towels at hurricane victims. And not only has the right jumped in to exploit this scandal, but the Weinstein bombshells have also spawned some of the most perverse takes on what to do about serial sexual harassment. Like former Trump White House advisor Sebastian Gorka, who cited Vice President Mike Pence's personal prohibition against eating alone with any woman who is not his wife. Gorka tweeted, "Think, if Weinstein had obeyed VP Pence's rules for meeting with the opposite sex, none of those poor women would ever have been abused." Can't believe I have to say this, but you should be able to be alone with a woman and not sexually assault her. In fact, if the only thing holding you back is that there are other people in the room, that's a problem. That's like saying, think, if Hannibal Lecter had kept kosher, those poor people would never have been eaten. Look, there are predators of all political persuasions and in both parties. This should not be a partisan issue. And moreover, women should not be held accountable for the predatory behavior of men. This is a problem with systemic misogyny and male entitlement, and men need to speak up and address their complicity in the system that allows these things to happen. You want to argue that Harvey Weinstein is just as bad as Donald Trump? Fine. Harvey Weinstein was, after far too long, found out and fired. Donald Trump has been found out for a year, and we're still waiting. What's the holdup? Not only has he been accused of sexual assault, he's also...
not a capable person.
This has been A Closer Look. You know our guest from his work on Saturday Night Live and such films as The Heat and 12 Years a Slave. He wrote, directed, and stars alongside Arnold Schwarzenegger in the new film Killing Gunther. It opens in select theaters and is available on demand October 20th. Please welcome back to the show our very good friend, Taryn Killam, everybody. Hi, buddy. It's so good to see you.
Thanks. Always wonderful to see you. Always.
So this is a film, sort of a mockumentary film.
Yes.
About hitmen trying to kill a hitman.
That's exactly right.
Played by Arnold Schwarzenegger.
This is true.
And you wrote this. When did you start writing this?
A long time. I think it was my second season of SNL. Yeah, like the summer. So it was about 6 years living with the script and trying to get it made and knew I wanted to be in it and knew I wanted to run around like a dummy and be an action star, which nobody else would hire me to do ever. Yeah. So.
And then you ended up directing it as well. That was not the original plan.
No. Just in terms of the hustle and trying to get it made, no one was living with it as much as I was. Nobody kind of saw what it would be, and I thought I'd, you know, take a swing.
So that's so exciting, because here you are writing a film, directing a film, starring in it, and then you get Arnold Schwarzenegger, which is really incredible.
It makes everything else so easy.
Yeah.
People just want to see it.
How was your working experience with him?
So great.
Yeah.
He is every bit the professional you expect him to be. He carries the confidence and charm and charisma of a man who was the best bodybuilder.
Yeah.
The best action movie star.
Yeah.
A governor of California.
A big state.
Big state. And was a blast, and kind and generous with his time for the cast and crew.
I ran into him last January, and it was hard for me to believe that you guys had worked together.
Yeah, we're buds.
And so I just kind of floated it and said, you know, I'm really good friends with Taryn Killam. And it was amazing how quickly he was like, oh, I love Taryn. Like,
I know, that's the thing. He sounds like that all the time.
Yeah, he does sound like that all the time.
Kobe says, I will never get used to, because I have the responsibility of calling him weekly on FaceTime and asking him to post social media things.
Gotcha.
Like, Taryn, what is it this week? Is it a Snapchat? Is it a GIF? Which is it?
And Kobe just says, I'll never get used to hearing that voice coming from, like, our bedroom.
Yeah.
And I said, get used to it, because I have big plans.
I feel like we're close enough in age to have had that, like, the Schwarzenegger movies were a canon of films that were really important.
Everything.
What, do you remember the first one you saw in the theater?
In the theater, I would say my first rated R movie in the theater was Terminator 2, which
perfect.
Blew my mind.
A perfect film.
And I did, for the next 3 or 4 years, get what's called a step cut.
Uh-huh.
To get Edward Furlong's haircut because I was that consumed by film.
Wait,
long, sweeping bangs to one side. Constantly walking up to ATMs, jamming in like Ralph's cards.
Okay, gotcha. A step cut. That's
step
fantastic.
Cut. Big into the step
and
cut.
And were you someone, because for us, it was every sleepover, I feel like we rented two Schwarzenegger movies.
Everything. Predator, yeah. Commando is huge.
Yep.
Commando is maybe like the first one in my memory, in my mind. And it has, there's something in the movie that I borrowed directly from that before I knew Arnold would be in this dumb little movie. It's him breaking into this like weapons armament, and he crashes a car through it, and he's grabbing weapons, and he unlocks a secret room and gets a four missile rocket launcher, and he loads up, and then the cops arrest him and they take all the weapons away.
I do remember how funny I thought it was, Commando particularly, because I feel like that was one with everything had a catchphrase.
Best
every
one-liners.
Death.
Best one-liners.
Yeah.
Hey, you said you were gonna kill me last. Oh yeah, I lied. He's that good. That's all you have to write.
He was also, here that's sort of the Schwarzenegger you think. Oh, that could be an action movie. You guys look like action guys.
Yes.
And then, but you also he wears like he's very game in the film. You have him wearing disguises, and I don't feel like I've seen that look before.
A little bit different. A little bit different for him. Yeah. And he was fully game. The first thing we shot was him in booty shorts and a tankini.
Wow.
And he couldn't have been more comfortable and was like,
how's everybody doing?
Do you have, having spent time on the film, obviously you were very busy directing and writing and starring, are there things that looking back you say, oh, I wish I'd done this with Arnold Schwarzenegger?
I got to do like 3 or 4 dinners, which were the best.
Yeah.
And hearing stories of him being cast in Terminator is the best. All I wanted to do was work out with him.
Sure.
I was like, please take me to the gym and call me a girly man or whatever.
Yeah.
And I was so busy that never happened. That's my biggest regret of the whole. But what's great is that I assumed he'd have like a state-of-the-art gym and stuff. He just goes to the local Y. We shot in Vancouver. He's like, oh, I've been there before. There's a Y. It's like $5 to get in. You can stay the whole day.
That's fantastic.
He's the best. He is truly the best.
It must be, if you're at that Y, you must think, hey, there's somebody over there who looks just like Arnold Schwarzenegger. You can't comprehend it's actually
not him.
It's
he must do birthday
he's
parties
a look-alike.
Or something. Yeah.
He's Canada's look-alike Arnold Schwarzenegger. I know we've talked about the LA Rams before. You're very happy.
Yes.
How do you feel? Where are you at?
We're doing better. We're 3-2, which is not great. We should have beat the Redskins. We should have beat Seattle.
Uh-huh.
But we're much better than last year. I feel like we could have a winning season. I'm not going to say playoff, but
you're kind of one of the few celebrity fans
on
the new Rams.
There's like a holy trinity of LA Rams
Who
fans.
Who are the three? So you?
Me.
Yeah.
Ty Burrell from Modern Family.
Okay, sure.
And Danny Trejo.
Yeah. What was Danny Trejo's movie? It's like Hatchet or something?
Yeah, Machete.
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 Yeah. Machete.
Machete. He makes the Jumbotron
a lot more. You were one of the great impressionists at SNL.
Thank you.
A few impressions, the people that I did not know before you did them that could be done. Brad Pitt is an example. But you also did Eminem.
Yeah.
And that's a very hard impression to do just because of the verbal gymnastics that he actually does.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I remember sitting next to Andy and I did it and Andy was like, that's a decent Eminem, which is like praise from Caesar.
Yeah.
Because Andy's cynical about everything.
Oh, yeah. the like, most
good Eminem.
The most Andy's ever liked anything is a little bit.
Yeah. Not bad.
Yeah.
Not bad. No,
meanwhile,
so cool.
He's like, doingity doing, doing, doing.
Schmorgy board. All Muppet impressions.
Yeah. He's like, that's a good Eminem, but watch my Swedish Chef. If you want to see a refined impression, do you, do you?
Yeah, no, the Eminem video that came out is so cool to see.
It was so cool to see.
Amazing.
Did you, watching it, were you thinking, oh, if I was on SNL this week, I would want to add to this?
No, because he said everything. I mean, I feel like he said everything that I was thinking and wanted out there. Except a couple of things.
Yeah.
And if I may.
Please.
I just want to, if that's. Yeah. All right.
Trump! Hold up. I'm going to start over. Trump!
He's so good. He just finds so many rhymes. Yeah.
He was because he was freestyling. Is that what you're doing?
Yeah, well,
I'm
just kind of off the top of the dome. But there's you find it in a dump. Trying to find a rhyme for Mar-a-Lago.
Oh,
just
yeah.
I feel like you need
that's a tough
the
one.
The parrot from Aladdin's Iago.
Okay, there you go.
Wasting money on Mar-a-Lago. He's a master.
Yeah,
he's
a master. I think it's
point.
A reminder.
He's incredible.
Is it what he does and what you do?
We get very, really not at all the same.
Thanks so much for being here, buddy. Congrats on the movie. Darren Gillum, everybody. Killing Gunther. This is like you.
With your host, Kevin Miller.
Hi, Taryn.
Hi, Kevin.
We're backstage.
We certainly are.
After your interview with Seth, and we just wanted to ask you a few more questions about the film Killing Gunther and first time directing and a few other things here.
Beautiful.
So you guys shot in Canada.
We shot in Vancouver, BC, yes.
Yeah, and how long were you there?
I went there right after my last season of SNL, so end of May until sort of first week of September. I was there for a while doing prep and location scouting. But the shoot itself was only 20 days.
Gotcha.
It was 4 weeks.
Yeah. There's some big stunts, big explosions.
Yeah.
How challenging was that to undertake and choreograph?
As a first-time director, it's what I was most nervous about. First and foremost, from a safety standpoint, even before quality, just because I didn't want that nightmare. You know, it's so important to me, and I knew I'd be asking stunt people and special effects people to be doing, you know, somewhat dangerous stuff. So I went above and beyond and overboard with the safety and orientations and rehearsal. Over and over rehearsal, we did storyboards. We did literal like maps. It was like we were planning a heist.
Yeah.
Because two of the bigger set pieces are like long oners. They look like single uncut shots that were broken up into chapters of like anywhere from 8 to 11 different individual sequences.
Has a real Birdman feel.
Exactly right. It's an Inuratu of incredibly low budget mockumentary comedies about hitmen.
Right.
It is that. So that's really what I worked the hardest on in prep. Were those bigger action, because I didn't want to come unprepared.
And no lawsuits.
Zero lawsuits. None.
That's great.
Not from filming.
Right.
Plenty previous.
Right. And so you just moved back. You were here in New York. You lived here for seven years.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Just moved back.
Mm-hmm. Back in California now. Yeah. Back in Los Angeles, sort of in and around where I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
Back near family. You know, as you know, I have two daughters, and they're with grandparents now and uncles and aunts on the weekends, and that just feels very nice.
Great. One of the coolest things, though, that I feel like you got to do before you went is you spent 4 months on Broadway in Hamilton. You played King George.
Yes. It was such a treat of a gig, especially doing a New York, a global institution like SNL. Doing Hamilton was kind of the best sort of come down job, you know? A great rebound gig in that it's so important to so many people. It's such a significant piece of art that means everything to the people who are watching it.
Yep.
And you feel that on stage. You feel that you're being allowed to be a part of this incredible expression. Yeah.
And you did 99 performances?
I did.
Was that?
Did you see that?
I did see that. I read that.
It was so frustrating. I'll tell you two stories about that.
Yeah.
Okay. So the first story is what you're hinting at, which is I was booked. I ended up doing 16 weeks and then another half week. They wanted me to carry over before Brian Darcy James, who originated the role, came back in. And I would have done exactly 100 performances, but I had to call out sick like 3 weeks before the end of my run. And I was like the most ill I've ever been in my life. And I was so furious, but I physically wasn't capable of doing it. So I had to call out sick, and it drove me crazy. And I was hoping that like they would delay one more show, but no, but it's also hilarious that it's 99 and not 100. Yeah. The other thing is the show before I found out I was sick, I was sick then too.
Mm-hmm.
And literally, like, would you know, the King does these three songs.
Yep.
I sang the first song. I wasn't feeling good going on stage. I sang the first song, immediately went to my dressing room and just vomited. Like, just was in my red satin King garb.
Oh, my gosh.
Huddled over this little backstage Broadway toilet. And then went back on. And between every song was
between
throwing
songs.
Up. Sweating. Was like, I was out of commission. And that, the one before I had to call out, was the best performance I gave.
Yeah.
Just because I was in such misery and so incapacitated backstage.
Oof. Yeah. That's rough.
But
that's rough.
The show
yeah.
must go on.
The show must go on. Well, during your time at SNL, I mean, how is it doing a performance every night like that physically to mm-hmm. doing a show like SNL in terms of preparation and just yeah. the physical aspect of performing like that?
There are many parallels. Mm-hmm. The live element of it and it being a comedic role, obviously, SNL helped prepare me for that. Yeah. But as you know, everything at SNL is expendable, right? Or disposable, right. even. Yeah. You're doing it, you maybe run it three times, it's done, it's on the air, and then right. you'll never do it again. And this was doing the same exact thing 99 times in a row. Mm-hmm. And I've never had that experience. I did theater growing up, but right. never a 16-week run.
Yeah.
And it was fascinating. It was yeah. fascinating to see. I mean, I think it's a testament to Lynn's show that it never got stale, mm-hmm. that it never felt boring or mm-hmm. repetitious. But it was just fascinating to see, even in the King's role, which is the smallest lead role in the show, yeah. how many different ways you can do it, yeah. how many different moments you can find.
Right. Was that nice to be able to have the same material to work with, but be able to change it up?
So much easier.
Yeah.
yeah. Coming out yeah. of SNL, yeah. where you're literally responsible for creating brand new material from scratch right. every week.
Right.
It was such a relief to like right. have everything ready for yeah. you.
Must be like a rock band of sorts playing their greatest hits. And it's yeah. like, how are we going to change it tonight?
Yeah, yeah exactly. Yeah. And yeah, I feel like I was probably like the new lead singer of Journey, you know?
sure.
Right. Where the Filipino guy is who came in. Do yeah. you know that story? He sounds just like Steve Perry, but, you know, yeah. makes it his own, too.
Yeah, sure. Well, that's great. Well, again, congratulations on
Thanks,
the
buddy.
Film, October
Thank
20th.
So yep.
It's in select cities
select
and theaters.
Select cities, yep. L.A., New York, yep. Like 8 other markets, I think. Yep. So maybe Chicago, Austin. And then that same day, you can do it video on demand.
thanks, Darren.
Thanks, buddy. Love you.
Okay, love you, too.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
You can rent it, you can own it. iTunes, Amazon.
Download it.
Cable,
get it.
Comcast.
Great.
DirecTV. I don't know if that's true, DirecTV.
All the digital realty retailers,
exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
Great.
Do you want to list them all?
Yeah, I'm going to list them all.
Okay,
and,
great.
Oh,
wait.
Okay. We've got Amazon. We've got Flibits.
Yeah.
We've got...
Oh, yeah, download it on Flibits, please.
yeah.
We get more kickback yeah. from them.
great.
Once upon a beat. Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. Once Upon a Beat.